Mediated conversation on SAFM.
26 minutes now to 9 the time. Good morning to you. Time for your first mediated conversation of the week. Last week, Statistics South Africa released a report demonstrating what you already know. South Africa is the worst or the highest inequality in the world. Of course, there are many reasons for this. Our past has created a situation of racialized inequality. Here, as in many other countries, it's also difficult to move from one class of society to another. But there are other reasons as well. It appears our education system is not allowing learners to move up in life as we might like them to. The report itself puts it like this towards the end. It says this: children of top earners have a higher probability of being top earners themselves, and this shows a strong transmission of advantage from one generation to the next at the top end of the labour market. Children of earners at the bottom of the earnings distribution have a very good probability of being low earners themselves. This shows extreme transmission of disadvantage from one generation to the next for those at the bottom end of the labour market. End quote. In other words, if you're born rich, you will live rich. If you are born poor, you will live poor, to use a different phrase. So then, how do we do what other countries have also tried so hard to do? How do we break the cycle of inequality? And while I ask you that question, I'm reminded of something that Professor Mark Swilling once said on this program, that in no democratic and free society have assets been taken from the rich and given to the poor. First, you'll hear about the report itself. Werner Ruch is the director responsible for research and budget at Statistics South Africa, who put this together. Then you'll hear from Precious Manisa, a research and budget analyst for Studies in Poverty and Inequality at the Institute there. We'll hear from her. And then we'll hear from Edward Malopi, an advocacy officer at the Socioeconomic Rights Institute. We'll ask Edward about what obligations, legal obligations, government has to try and deal with this. We're going to get Werner Ruch from the Institute, from Statistics South Africa, back on the line in just a moment, just to try and start by asking him what the report actually found last week. That's going to be the way that we start this conversation. The line has literally just dropped in the last second. So we'll get Werner Ruch back from Statistics South Africa and start the conversation there. All right, Werner Ruch, good morning to you, and thank you very much indeed for your time.
Yes, thank you.
I would like to start with a definition, please. I'm presuming that when we talk about inequality, we simply mean there are some people who are rich and there are many who are poor. Would that be correct?
Yeah, so inequality is actually a very complex phenomena to measure. Inequality manifests itself in economic ways and social ways, and there isn't a clear headline indicator. So a lot of times when you look at something like unemployment, you have the unemployment rate, and that can tell you quite a large story. Look at poverty as the poverty headcount. Now, South Africa has commonly defaulted to using the Gini coefficient as our sort of predominant inequality measurement tool. But what we've done in this new inequality trends report is actually try to embrace the multidimensionality of inequality and to look at it in various different domains to try and get a more well-rounded understanding of inequality. But at its roots, you are correct to say that it's what are the differences that exist between groups of people and between different geographies.
Okay, I'm going to come to gender, and I want to come to the urban-rural split in just a moment. But I do, and I think we should focus on race for a moment first. And I'm presuming that your report finds what I think we all already know. White people are the richest, and then black people are the poorest. What differences do you find among different racial groups?
Yeah, so I think that as a ballpark, that's generally true, that we find that richer households in this country tend to be white, and the poorer ones tend to be black African. But I think if we take a step back to try and understand, so when we look at, let's first say, economic measures, right? We have a wide variety of different measures that we looked at for the report. And what we overall see is that inequality has decreased for whites and for Indian Asians, stayed fairly constant for colored, but has increased for black Africans. But I think the thing to remember, though, is also, so that is in the different groups. If we're now looking at black Africans against black Africans. So when you put everyone in South Africa together in one pot, we actually have very, very, very high levels of inequality. But what is more interesting is if you're zooming in to these individual groups, we actually see that there is the where inequality is growing fastest is actually amongst Black Africans. The distance between the rich Black Africans and poor Black Africans is growing as well.
Stop me if I get this wrong, but that on one level is good news, right? It shows that there are Black people who are becoming rich.
In one way, you could say that that's positive because there are Black people who are becoming rich. But I think what happens is that what we're seeing now is that there is an increasing gap that is growing amongst Black Africans when it comes to inequality. So it pulls maybe the richer one up, but it's a very small select group. And the majority actually stay behind. And you can see that when you actually then look at South Africa collectively as one pot, that the inequality levels go up even further. So in some ways it's positive, but in other ways it should be something we should be very aware of and see how it continues to move in the future, that it doesn't become a more significant problem.
Okay. Then let's talk about the urban-rural split now. And again, my presumption is that people in urban areas are richer.
Yes. So, well, I think there's twofold. So if we look now, if we take a step back and look at poverty, we know that people living in rural areas carry a greater burden when it comes to poverty. If we just look to the upper bound poverty line, I think in 2015, we had around where 40% of those living in urban areas were poor, is around 80% of those living in rural areas were poor. So when we move to the inequality realm, though, it is also important to remember that when we look at intergroup, meaning that if we look at just a rural area by itself, it often doesn't necessarily mean that there are high levels of inequality amongst that group. If everyone in that community is poor, then the actual inequality between those people are quite low. So it's just one of this very interesting dynamics that you have to always constantly weigh and understand. But yes, overall, when we look at those who carry the burden of inequality, just like with poverty, rural areas are more harder hit.
Okay, you say in your report, if I've read it correctly, and maybe I didn't, but there has been some progress in reducing inequality. I mean, when we look around us, it must be very small progress. What progress has been made?
Well, so overall, we've seen that when it comes to the economic measures, that we have gone down. The Gini is lower, and other measures that we introduced in the report, such as the Palmer ratio, have also gone down. The problem is that in recent years, particularly from 2011 to 2015, the progress that we were seeing started to slow down, and we weren't making as much. So I think that's the one general thing that we've observed. When it comes to asset inequality, what we have seen, so on the positive side, we see that within the asset profiles, Black Africans actually saw the largest increase in asset ownership between 2009 and 2015, more so than any other population group. The challenge is that since they start at such a low base, even with the faster gains, they still are behind the levels of ownership that you would see in other in other population groups. I guess if you really wanted to try and zero in on some of the more success stories, I think the one that really stands out is in the social sphere with regards to health. So with regards to education, the three main areas we looked at was access to basic services, access to healthcare, and access to education. So on education, we see that between 2002 and 2017, school attendance between 6 and 18 years aged people has increased. So more children are attending schools. We also can see that attendance at schools was tremendously boosted by the government's no-fee policy, which then by 2007, when it was fully implemented, has helped a lot of previously disadvantaged families to get their children into school and to give them access to education. And other than Gauteng and Western Cape, we see that government's nutrition programs are very successful in feeding school-going kids. So this is another one, and it's a big role. Education plays a very significant part in trying to prepare individuals for the labor market, because it's really once they reach the labor market that some of these inequalities in terms of what your wages are and things like that come and begin to manifest themselves.
All right, Werner Ruch, thank you very much indeed. Really do appreciate it. Director responsible for research and budget at Statistics South Africa with what that report found. It's just going to 8:45 now. The time you mediate a conversation continues. We're talking, of course, about inequality. Precious Manisa is a research and budget analyst for studies in poverty and inequality at the Studies for Poverty and Inequality Institute on the line now. Precious, good morning.
Morning, Steve. Morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Okay, we hear the numbers. We hear what the analysis says. What does this mean for the lived experience of people? And I suppose there'll be some who, if they're thirsty, have three bathrooms to choose from, and for others, you have to actually trudge to a village tap to get some water.
Sure. Just to also add on, on what the first caller said, we can't ignore the fact that South Africa still remains the most unequal country in the world, right? And it has been persistent since the dawn of democracy, and little progress has been made in addressing the ills of the past. But then reverting back to your question, which generally focuses on basic services such as your water, your sanitation, electricity, and so on and so on. And when you look at the trends in relation to water and for instance, most particularly with water in relation to provinces, whereby you have provinces such as your Limpopo and Eastern Cape who are really behind when it comes to inequality in relation to this access of basic services. And also there's been the provinces with the lowest proportion of households with access to pipe water and tap water and so on and so on. But then, why at least you have provinces like Gauteng, Western Cape, Northern Cape, and Free State who are amongst the four provinces that are consistently being above the national rate.
Okay, I'd imagine one place you see this is where, for example, you have a child who breaks an arm. Right? Healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are rich, you go to wherever, Santon MediClinic, you're greeted by a receptionist, you're given a cup of coffee or whatever. If you are, say, for example, in a rural area in the Western Cape and you have very little money or no money at all, the chances are your child could go for a week before that arm is set.
Sorry, can you repeat?
I'm saying if you're a poor person in the Eastern Cape, your child might be suffering with a broken arm for a very long time before they receive proper treatment. Health is where you rarely see this.
I'm not really sure if I do understand your question, because you are breaking up a bit.
The point I'm trying to make is that you rarely see inequality in healthcare in South Africa. That's where you see it.
Sure. So, there is a very huge gap in the healthcare between the use of public and private healthcare facilities. And we see a very huge gap or division in terms of the use of healthcare facilities, particularly when we look at the population groups, whereby you have, for instance, according to the report, it generally says that you have 8 out of 10 black-headed households who use public healthcare facilities compared to one in ten of the white-headed households who use the services. So by just looking at this, those proportions haven't really changed much between 2009 and 2017, right? And also this implies in both the rural and urban areas, whereby you see a division in society between the rich who tend to use private healthcare facilities and the poor who largely have to rely on public services.
As inequality intensifies, what does that mean for our society? Can it mean that trust breaks down? People won't trust the system, for example. Frustration and anger would mount.
Yes. Honestly speaking, trust, has been already broken in South Africa among citizens, and people no longer trust the government or the system or the law. And also, people don't really see the importance of moving forward with whatever the government proposes. And because, why? Because so many promises have been made by the government, and a few of them have been actually fulfilled. So, yeah, I believe that trust is already broken among our citizens.
Thank you very much indeed, Precious Manisa. Do appreciate it. Research and budget analyst at the Studies for Poverty and Inequality Institute. Your mediated conversation will continue. It's 10 minutes now to 9 o'clock.
Mediated conversation on SAFM.
8 minutes to nine, the time. Good morning to you. Your mediated conversation around inequality continues. Let's speak now to the Socioeconomic Rights Institute. They, of course, look at issues of inequality, also from a legal perspective. Advocacy officer there is Edward Malopi. Edward, hi, good morning.
Good morning, Stephen, and good morning to the SAFM listeners.
Firstly, what obligation does government have to try and reduce inequality, and I suppose at the same time to reduce poverty? Is there a deliberate obligation on government to try and do this?
Certainly. I mean, I think if you look at it, we have a constitution that guides how we govern ourselves as a society. And within that constitution, there is what is called the Bill of Rights, right? And running across that Bill of Rights, you find a number of instances where the state is given an obligation to fulfill particular mandates that relate to socioeconomic rights. So, for example, let's take issues of housing, for example. The Constitution will tell us that everybody has the right of access to adequate housing. And then immediately after that, it will then tell us that the state must take reasonable legislative and any other means within the resources that the state has to ensure that it achieves the progressive realization of this right. This we also find the same wording when you look at Section 27, which looks at healthcare, food, water, and social security. So this is something that is clearly outlined within the Constitution, that the state has an obligation to ensure that there is some sort of equality that reigns within our society.
Do you believe government has actually tried to do these things?
So I think it varies from case to case. And if you look at how they have handled some of the issues, when it comes to issues of policy and legislation, you'll find that the state does put those in place. But then they, on the next day, come again and act contrary to those policy and legislation that they've put in place. So let's take, for example, issues of street trading, where you find people who are unemployed and don't have a way of getting access to formal employment. They then come together and say that because I don't have a job, I'm going to sell these goods on the street, and then they do that. And then the state then comes in and sort of like demolishes what they have put together in a way that goes against all the policies that they've had in place. I'm referring to a few specific cases here where, for example, in 2013, you see people trading in the inner city of Johannesburg with operating licenses from the city of Johannesburg. And instead of the city coming in and ensuring that there is a framework that protects their right to trade, they then come in and illegally evict them from their place of work. So the state will have policies in some cases, but then they will come again and act contrary to those policies that they themselves have put in place.
Okay. The idea of a basic income grant, I mean, one of the advantages of a basic income grant is that it is progressive. In other words, it takes money from the rich and gives to the poor without causing all of the political difficulties you would find in trying to take assets from the rich to give those to the poor, which is very difficult to do because the rich will mobilize against that. Would you support then the idea of a basic income grant? I mean, would that make a big difference if we were to try and implement something like that?
So I mean, I think we have just done research that looks at life in informal settlement, for example. And you actually do see that people do actually rely on grants that come from the state as part of the income that they have. So and it's not the only income, of course, that they are relying on, but essentially state assistance in terms of grants is something that has been shown to assist people in the difficult circumstances that they find themselves in. So I think state support where people are finding it difficult to earn a living is something that we can support.
So you don't think that grants actually reduce inequality at all? I mean, isn't there some evidence that shows that social grants have reduced the Gini coefficient quite dramatically?
Well, what I think is that people are finding it incredibly difficult to live without any sort of income, and so whenever the state exists to ensure that I think it plays that facilitation role where it distributes resources. That's the role of the state, to distribute resources in an equitable manner. And how they do that, we can look into it and debate it. But I think the fact of the matter is the state needs to be there to distribute resources in an equal manner.
Okay. Are you expecting anything to change? I mean, in 10 years' time, do you think our inequality numbers are going to be the same? It would seem like it.
I mean, at the current trajectory, yes. The situation is not changing for the better in any way. And so that is why it is important that we push that the state does what it needs to be doing so that it reaches. What these tests actually show us is that we cannot relax in the current situation, and that we really do need to be working proactively to ensure that inequality is reduced in South Africa.
Edward Malopi, thank you very much indeed. Really do appreciate the time. Advocacy Officer at the Socioeconomic Rights Institute. My thanks also to Precious Manisa, a Research and Budget Analyst at the Institute for Budget and Inequality. And then my thanks also to Werner Ruch, Director Responsible for Research and Budget at Statistics South Africa, starting basically having a conversation there about inequality. We're looking at a conversation around unions and the attitudes of people to unions tomorrow. That is something that we're going to be looking at. We'll also, of course, continue the conversations around SAA. Bongi Gwala is going to be looking at that. He's also going to be looking at John Steenhuisen, the new interim leader of the Democratic Alliance. All of those conversations coming your way here on SAFM. More news as well between 12 and 1 today. You with SAFM leading the conversation. Good morning, 9 o'clock.